the appearance of a dream. So it wouldn't be able to cause you any attachment or aversion or any suffering. So that's the point of this whole thing. That's the point of all of this. And actually, the next part, did Rinpoche do it? Where did he get to, actually? He didn't do it all, in fact.
No. He only went to the vision. It crossed into positive. And then those split into two eclipses and didn't have that.
It appears in wisdom, yeah. Okay, then we've done what Rinpoche did also.
Yeah.
So it fits perfectly. Gewandi.
Pati mato chitama. Sanna dekendo. Ina ato tano sang gobare. Koso suncho la dege doge sofi la de kade doge doke deke na tiha koko doga. Suncho ta sofi la dingi na. Yang suncho la yang kie chukure. Tini tereng Gobate Mahina Dhirwa, Tanda Amogobandona, Yang San Yanja Kitu Gobate. Then Yang Tarsong Yang Yapodi. Yavadi Munjur Limbo.
Munjur Limbo, Guye Tahi.
Let our Mick play. Yeah, we got
in
to.
In the book, we were at the page 42, we didn't.
I know. Yeah. We know your tape recorder is not as clever as you are. Your tape recorder doesn't have the Buddha nature, that's why. So, through focusing, and that means through habituation to a mental cultivation where focusing, as has been explained, is practiced thus. So in other words, through focusing on all phenomena as being mind appearances, what will evolve is that all phenomena as being merely awareness or mind only is focused on. So since anything that appears is the deluded projection of the mind experiencing it, what is being experienced is that mind. It is merely the awareness of the mind itself, or the perceived aspect of that awareness, which is being focused on. And through establishing that, the breakthrough is achieved in which there are no outer reference as assumed on which to focus. So as assumed means that since they were appearing as outer things, one assumed them to be so. And it turns out that there are no reference for the terms that one uses and the objects that one thinks are being experienced by consciousnesses. Through there being no such reference that could be focused on, it will follow that there is no perceiver of this and that. So there's no perceiver of a flower, no perceiver of a fire, and so on. That is, no such mere awareness on which to focus. So since the fire and the flower and so on were the awareness, and since they don't exist, then the awareness of them is not there to focus on either. Through that perceiver not existing on which to focus, this is the critical stage, right? When you realize that the perceiver doesn't exist, then the verge is crossed into focusing on reality. This is why this Lajukva was translated, the verge is crossed, because this is the critical step that is taken here, right? Where one steps into reality, which is the suchness transcending thought and expression. So this unchanging nature of mind is something which cannot be fathomed by thought. It cannot be conceived by thought. There is not enough room for it in conceptual thinking. And because it can't be thought, it also can't be expressed in words and conventional terms. And it is free of duality in that there is no twofold division into perceived and perceiver. So this non-dual consciousness is the genuine reality. And in the Shentong explanation of that, the non-dual consciousness is not thought of as being ultimately truly existent. It's not being truly existent in an ultimate sense. That is to say, one speaks of it as being truly existent, but that's in a conventional way. And one can speak of it as truly existent because it is that reality which is really there. So because it's true, it's not a lie, that's what really is there, you can talk about it as being truly existent. But that's only from the point of view of concepts, true as the opposite of false. So you say that clear light, which is empty of duality of perceived and perceiver and is therefore free of all conceptual elaborations, truly exist. It's not a fake. It's not false. But ultimately speaking, or within that mind itself, then to speak of true existence doesn't make any. It wouldn't apply because it's just a term, true existence. It's a word, and words don't apply to that nature. Words and concepts don't apply. So to call it truly existent or non-existent or anything else doesn't apply. So that's an important point to notice because the Rongtong school attacks the Shentong for just being another form of Chittamatra. But there's a difference because the Chittamatra school claims true existence of that non-dual consciousness in an ultimate sense. Whereas the Shentong only claims that as from the perspective of it's being the opposite, it's true as the opposite of false in terms of our relative way of understanding things conceptually. So it's a very fine distinction, but it's important to catch it. This having evolved, there are no phenomena whatsoever, meaning anything perceived and a perceiver of it, as a result of a split into these two, existing on which to focus. This is what is called original non-conceptual wisdom. Since this is what is defined with the utmost precision with respect to its involving no object whatsoever, serving as a focal reference, no focusing agent of any sort as an observer, and as a result, no attributes in any sense, such as the existence of perceived and perceiver, the non-existence, and so on which to focus at all. So since they turn out to be false, you know, the whole interplay of perceived and perceiver cannot be established with logic, it doesn't mean that we turn around and say these are truly non-existent, so that one would develop a nihilistic view. The freedom from them is also free of conceptual elaborations. And this term conceptual elaborations always means thinking of things as existing or not existing. So one doesn't turn around and make that clear light, empty of perceiving perceiver, an object of thought by saying it has this and that attribute, namely it doesn't exist, and so on. So when, in other words, it's saying this genuine reality is not something that you can have as an object of the thinking mind in any of the ways that you could think about it. Then you have to come with your hand. Then you get a spoon and we can put some in everybody's hand. But if we do that, then I'll have to sing a song. Now I lost the page. 42. Because of this, there are not even the subtlest grounds on which anything included under conceptual factors could be posited. So it goes completely beyond what the rational mind can work with. And this is where the philosophers get angry, you know, because many of the philosophers in the Western tradition try to get everything captured under rational mind. And if something escapes rational mind, then they don't accept it. Yeah, it's a big hang-up. Because they don't accept that, they can never get the full picture of how things really are. And the physicists are also having problems with it, and they don't want to accept that since they can't find any ultimate particle existing, that actually it's mind, even though they can measure that there is this intimate connection between the mind observing, doing the experiment, and the experiment being done. Yeah, interconnected. And it's all, well, they haven't been able to make the step that because there is no solid essence, there is no real object, and therefore what we perceive as object must be mind. It's too subtle a step for them. Apparently, it's too frightening, or it's somehow you can't, when you can't measure it, or, you know, then it's, they conceive of that as being non-scientific, but it's not, because it's the description of how things really are, which they claimed to be looking for when they started the investigation. Well, this goes back to the old hang-up between religion and science, which they try to artificially now to reinforce and to keep. But because it's an artificial idea, then they are blocked for seeing how genuine reality actually is. Many of the religious people are blocked because they refuse to accept the scientific statement. And the scientists are blocked because they refuse to take the extra step of seeing the phenomenon mind. Yeah, then one starts to think of oneself as the creator of the universe and and all the rest that would go with it. Yeah. So maybe it's better they don't figure it out. Or if they do, if they do figure it out, maybe if they contact Rinpoche, then it'll be all right. Yeah, obviously. You can find cola everywhere in the universe, therefore Americans are the creators of the world.
Oh, no.
So the eighth is as follows. So we've gone back to the main outline, which was 10 points dealing with the subject of transformation. Now we're at number eight, which was called application. And now we're going to see what that means. The penetration of levels through application. So it is an analysis of various stages of development. Should be known to include the following four degrees. Through intense application involving informed commitment. In Tibetan? What it means in English. Informed means the opposite of uneducated. You know, informed means you know what you're doing. you've got the sufficient information on which to base what you're doing. So it's an intelligent act. And then commitment means that you have decided completely to do it and have dedicated yourself to that. So through intense application involving informed commitments, this level called training by way of informed commitment comprises the stage of definitive verification, which refers to the jhalan, path of application. Then the next one, through application of true concrete realization of the levels, the first, meaning the first bodhisattva level, is the stage the precise is encountered. Then the next one, through intense application employing meditation, so this is the path of meditation, the impure levels, as well as the purified three, are what comprise the stage of recollection. And at this point, the Tibetan says dak in some texts and druk in others. And it was translated as dak, and she said you could translate it either way. If you translate it as dak, then it's this purified three. The impure levels as well as the... Wait a minute. Anyway, I'll have to look at the Tibetan to figure out which word to do with it. So, through intense application employing meditation, the impure levels as well as the purified three are what comprise the stage of recollection. So that's the third one. And then the fourth, through application involving final perfection, the spontaneous deeds of the Buddha are uninterrupted, hence this is the stage of immersion into the core. So that's the description of the path of no more learning. And the first three are the path of learning. So then the commentary on this, Rinpoche didn't actually give very much commentary on this section at all. But I'll try to catch what he did say. So he started out by saying, if you're diligent in practicing the path, then the development that you will go through will take four different main stages. You can break it down into four main stages. And so the penetration of the distinctive plateaus or levels of development represented by the graded progression of the paths and levels through putting original wisdom into practice, that is to say, through the application and effort expended in this regard, should be known to include the following four. So it's actually much more than four. It's the five paths and the ten bhumis organized in four main plateaus. But at this point, path of accumulation is not mentioned. So we can't really say it's all five of the paths. We're taking it from the path of application and up. So even though the reality of pure being has not been directly realized, through intense application to its meaning, involving the medium of informed commitment, which is based on the three types of knowledge, this level called training by way of informed commitment is entered. This comprises the stage associated with the path of application, which is an approximation of definitive verification. So to look at that again, the term informed commitment is meant to convey the idea that one has no direct way of seeing the emptiness yet. The actual emptiness is inaccessible at this point in one's development. So the only way that you can relate to it is through through being committed to realizing it. And that commitment can't be just a matter of blind faith. Because if it's blind, then it won't know what to do. So it has to be a kind of commitment which is intelligent and has the kind of intelligence that is able to, as it were, visualize the emptiness. I mean, that's not quite the right word for it. But it has that sort of a sense. This mirpa that is being used in the Tibetan has the sense of imagining. One has to imagine the emptiness because one can't see it. To see it directly would be in the same sort of way. Well, I mean, what we talk about as direct perception means when we see things with our eyes, hear them with our ears, and so on. So there is no need of an intermediary of any sort, and it's not an indirect process based on deduction, but you just experience it directly. That kind of experience one does not have at this point. So what to do? One has to use the abstract idea of emptiness, the general idea, which has been pointed out by the teacher and the texts. And then one works with that through the three types of prajna, through the knowledge arising from listening, the knowledge arising from reflection, and the knowledge arising from meditation. And gradually, that abstract idea that one has of emptiness will become more and more transparent. It will become more and more subtle, and closer to the actual emptiness, until finally it drops away and one is able to see the emptiness directly. So that's what's meant by these words saying, even though the reality of pure being has not been directly realized, there is a way to get to it, namely through intense application to its meaning, and there one uses the medium of informed commitment, which is based on the three types of knowledge. And through doing this, then, one has this path called training by way of informed commitment, which is the path of application. And this whole path is called an approximation of definitive verification, which is a new point. When this was introduced earlier in the text, it was just called definitive verification, which meant that one, in a very definite way, finds out the truth about the emptiness. But that's not quite the case, because one does not really find out the truth about the emptiness, the full truth, until the path of seeing. So the whole path of application is an approximation of that actual definitive verification that occurs at the instant of directly seeing the emptiness. So why does one call the path of application definitive verification if it's not? And this is the idea is that one gives the name of the result to the cause. For example, you say, and we do this also in ordinary life, right? You say, this is the Hamburg highway, right? And it doesn't mean you're in Hamburg, but it's the highway that will take you to Hamburg, right? So you say it's the Hamburg Autobahn, right? And then as soon as you get past Hamburg, then you call it the Frankfurt Autobahn, or whichever one is the next. So you're giving the name of the destination to the path, which we do all the time in various ways, right? And this same thing is done, for example, when we're practicing the Vajrayana practices, doing a sadhana, for example, then in that context of the offering circle, all those who are participating are yogis and yoginis, because they are practicing the path of the Vajrayana, which involves yogic insight. And even though they haven't fully developed that insight yet, the name of the result is given to the path. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. But it's a kind of skillful means for helping you get into it, you know. Because if you can imagine yourself as being that, then it's easier to be it. Whereas if you can't even get the picture of yourself in that way, then there's no way to get there. So as long as one doesn't use it as an occasion for pride and thinking that one really is a great yogi or yogin, then it doesn't act as a hindrance. But these days the tradition is that if you're called a yogi and yogin, you think you really are one, and it becomes a block.
Like a Buddhist, you know? Us being called Buddhist, I mean, we're not actually Buddhist.
One could say that, yeah. I mean, in a sense, you don't really take refuge until you, at the end of the 10th level of Bodhisattva, and you go through the Vajrapana Samadhi and become a Buddha, then you've really taken refuge. Right? The rest of it is an approximation. Yeah. But one has to have that approximation, right? Otherwise you can't start, you can't get anywhere. So that finishes that one, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're at first level bodhisattvas. Through it's a good course. Great. Through application of true concrete realization to the reality of pure being, not just an abstract idea of it, the bodhisattva levels are entered, the first of which is the stage where the precise is encountered, that is, the precise nature is directly encountered. So what does it mean, true concrete realization? It's called concrete here because it's the opposite of abstract. And the commentary says it's not just an abstract idea of it anymore. So what kind of realization is that? And is an abstract, is concrete. And this is the stepping over the verge into, the verge is crossed into that reality in which there is no duality, seen directly. So one starts to get a feeling of how practical the path is and the way that it's taught. Because one is constantly told how to imagine oneself being on the next level. You start by imagining that consciousness empty of duality. And by imagining it and getting a clearer and clearer idea of it, then suddenly you can see it. Then that meditative equipoise is finished, then you go around for some time and see everything as being illusory appearances, like in a dream. And then you sit down to the next meditative equipoise, and then you enter the second bodhisattva level. Through intense application, employing repeated meditation on the precise nature which has already been realized, one enters what are commonly known as the six impure levels, ranging from the second to the seventh, which comprises the stage involving maintenance of attributes, as well as the three levels from the eighth onwards which are purified of this. These last nine levels together are what comprise the stage of recollection of the reality already realized. Yes, that is a difficult phrase. I was hoping we could skip over it and go on to the next page. She's talking about this thing of maintenance of attributes. Yeah. So now we're on the bodhisattva level, and suddenly we're maintenance men, right? The maintenance women. So it's like we're just the cleaning lady, right? Mm-hmm. No, you can erase that from your tapes. So this is another form of application, and what one is applying the mind to is that realization of emptiness which has already been achieved, and it goes through these 9 degrees from the second bodhisattva level up to and including the 10th. And the first six of those, the first six from the second to the seventh, are called the impure levels, the six impure. And the reason why they're called impure is because they're the stage involving maintenance of attributes. And that means that there is still a subtle degree of the type of conceptuality in which names are associated with reference, where one conceptually mixes name and referent as being the same thing, which is the way that we perceive things. We perceive things in terms of, for example, when you see a shape, then what enables you to see that shape is the color. You know, your eye goes out to as far as the white goes. And then you know, where the white stops and the yellow starts, then the shapes, when one differentiates the shapes by those colors. So one thinks of terms of things in terms of their color. That's one of the attributes. Right? This is red, this is white. And I can see the difference between your dress and your socks because the dress is red and the socks are green. And I can see where your face starts and where your hair starts because of the colors. And at least that's part of it, right? Color and shape to go together. So those attributes are part of the way that we reinforce the idea of reality of things. And the bodhisattvas are not seeing those forms as being truly existent anymore. They're seeing them as illusory. But there is still a degree of clinging to the attributes and mixing name and referent. There's still a degree of that. That's one reason why the transformation of consciousness is not complete yet. There's still this subtle aspect of the process of consciousness left over. Then from the eighth level up to and including the tenth, then there is no more of this maintenance of attributes. There's no more conceptually mixing name and referent into one. Then the question is, how does an eighth level bodhisattva experience things if he's not experiencing things in terms of their attributes? And if there's no mixing of name and referent? Well, one thing it would mean would be a perfectly seeing that any attributes of things are illusory attributes, as just like attributes in a dream. So it's a slightly more subtle level of the whole process. They already got the realization on the first level that the object as such is illusory. And then on the eighth level, they get like the full realization of that the attributes of the object are also illusory. And then what is perceived after that is both appearance and attributes as being like the appearance and attributes experienced in a dream. And it doesn't mean that the bodhisattva on that level is not able to call things by their name anymore. You know, even though they are not mixing the name and the referent together as being one thing, but they still see, you know, they still have an understanding of what sort of names beings apply to what sort of objects, so they can still make that kind of an association. But in their own minds, they're not mixing them together as one. So So all appearances are appearing clearly without being blurred together, just like the colors in a rainbow, where the green doesn't mix with the blue and the blue doesn't mix with the red. Each is separate. And yet these attributes are seen as being empty of any substantial essence, as they are in a rainbow. The habitual patterns behind the appearances, right? Mm-hmm. Those are still not gone, even at the eighth level. They're not gone until the end of the tenth. So that means that 8th, 9th and 10th level bodhisattvas have dreams, for example.
Yeah.
Because there are still bhakchaka producing appearances.
But
I don't know. I mean, at that level would be complete equality experience in the appearances, so nice and not nice would be seen as equal.
But what? 8th, 9th, 10th level bodhisattvas have dreams and others not?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Buddhas don't have dreams.
Buddhas don't have dreams, no. Maybe everybody should be ready to turn off the tape recorder when Veronica says something. Either that or you have to realize that the sound of Veronica's voice is sound and emptiness and separable, like in a dream.
So if they sleep, they just remain in the pure light.
Exactly. They can finally rest, but they don't have to have all these dreams also. But, of course, Buddhas don't sleep either.
Insomnia. Stroke, it's okay.
What to do? Pardon?
Like talking about
Buddhas, don't they sleep at all?
And also, for Buddha, there's no difference between the state of meditative equipoise and the post-meditative state.
But for example, Karmapa sleeps or not? Because I heard that, for example, Tengah Rinpoche is just two weeks per day. Meditating.
Hmm. Yeah, we have to also remember that we're getting these teachings from the Sutayana level. Right? Slightly different explanation on the Vajrayana level. I want you to keep that in mind. And that's part of the confusion that arises, because people say things, but they don't realize which level of teaching they're talking about themselves. Right? So everything gets all confused.
So you are talking about Shakyamuni Buddha.
Yeah, at this point, yeah. And, from the... from the Sutayana point of view, then... Now that's a more complicated question. Because the three types of tulku. So. But here we're just analyzing it from the point of view of whether... one is an ordinary being on the path of abdication, a realized being on the 10 levels, or a Buddha. So, this whole level of development, which is quite vast, you know, going from the second to the 10th level, and which in the Mahayana system can take kalpas, right? You know, one hears of the Mahayana path as taking 3 endless kalpas, or 7 endless kalpas, or 37 endless kalpas. And that's part of the reason for that is that one can stay on the bodhisattva levels for many kalpas. For example, Maitreya, as a 10th level bodhisattva, is in the Tushita heaven, has been there. I don't know when he got there. 19... it wasn't. But he will be there until he manifests as the 5th Buddha. And sometimes the bodhisattvas are reborn in the God realms. in the ordinary samsaric god realms to give teachings there. So the bodhisattva levels can last for many kalpas, but one is already realized, so it's not like one is just suffering like an ordinary being. It's the kind of suffering that's like suffering in a dream, so you know, the more the better. Through application involving the level of final perfection, the spontaneous, that is to say, effortless deeds of a Buddha are uninterruptedly engaged in as long as there are beings and throughout the reaches of space. Hence, this form of application is the stage of immersion into the core of pure being, purged of the two obscurations, the unchanging original wisdom, which is undifferentiable from the expanse. So here, Rinpoche made a very important distinction. And it's connected with this last phrase, the unchanging original wisdom. That unchanging original wisdom is what is seeing pure being. So this is a Shentong kind of distinction. And this is another point that the Rongtongs debate. If you take the literal meaning of Yeshe, it's original consciousness. So it indicates that there's some process, there's some sort of consciousness, an awareness of something. And what original consciousness or wisdom is aware of is pure being. However, it is aware of it in a way that is undifferentiable from the expanse. So the expanse is another term for pure being. And this wisdom which is aware of pure being is at the same time inseparable from that expanse of pure being. So it is in a completely non-dualistic way. It is in the same sort of way that Rinpoche has been pointing out to us in the emptiness meditation class, to rest in a way in which there is nothing being focused on and no focuser. There is not an object of the awareness and a subject of the awareness. There is not something being meditated on and a meditator as two different things. They are indifferentiable. They are not the same, they are not different. Pure being is the object perceived by, let's not use the word perceived at this point, the object of which the wisdom is aware, and that wisdom itself is the aware aspect of that pure being, without these two being two different things. And this is a point which the Rongtongs attack and say, this is this is not going to wash. We won't accept this. So the Rongtongs say that ultimately there is no wisdom. The Rongtong explanation does not posit Yeshe as being an ultimate factor, but as being a relative factor. Which means that even the qualities of a Buddha for a Rongtongpa are relative. And then the Shentongpas attack that position and saying if the qualities of a Buddha are relative, then they're impermanent. So the Buddha would be impermanent. Then they leave, I think.
So the Rongtongs, they think that one has to create the qualities by way of wisdom and...
The qualities of the Buddha are newly created. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, the Shentong attack it and say if it's newly created, it's impermanent. Mm-hmm. But as far as I understand it, the Rongtong answer is that the two form kayas are relative and only the Dharmakaya is the ultimate Buddha.
I mean, what is the Dharmakaya? I mean,
that's the expanse. The expanse of pure being. But it leaves, I mean, for my intuition, if you don't have an awareness of pure being, then what good is it? You know, it's just sort of hanging out there in being itself, right? But if you're not aware of it, then what's the use? If there's no wisdom, then what's the use? And if the Buddha is only the Dharmakaya, then the three kayas are not an ultimate explanation. You know, it's sort of like you've got relative Buddha and ultimate Buddha. So even at the level of Buddhahood, there would be this kind of duality. So, and also, in the Rongtong position, you don't have any real explanation of why there should be all these qualities of the Buddha appearing suddenly, if the ultimate nature is just pure being and nothing else.
Just expanse.
Yeah, then why would there be anything in that expanse?
Do they say just emptiness as well?
Yeah, the main position of the Rongtong, there are these different schools among the Rongtongpas, right? But the highest level of those are the Prasangikas, those who have the most perfect Rongtong view. And for them, Semji Ne Lup Tongpa Ni Tripadang Drawari. It's the emptiness free of all conceptual elaboration, period.
And does that mean it doesn't have the luminous quality, the creative?
Yes, exactly. They don't explain it in terms of Sartong Nirme.
Mm-hmm.
Luminosity and emptiness inseparable. It's just emptiness with no conceptual fabrication. So how they practice the Vajrayani is a question.
Yeah, that's kind of...
No, it's not nihilism because it's not thought of as being a truly existent non-thing, or it's not a truly existent negation of things. It's just...